had a so-called single event upset where tremendous amounts of damage has occurred from events like this. And if you've got an astronaut in space doing a spacewalk during one of these events, he's going to see an awful lot of extra radiation. When he climbs back into his space station, so to speak, or his space capsule, he has a lot more shielding material around him, and he's being a lot more protected. When you get out of the Earth's magnetic field, because you're on the way to the Moon or on the way to Mars, you've got to worry about whether or not the Sun is going to give you one of these events, because your astronauts are at great risk when that occurs. So maybe this is a little bit of what you're talking about here, Glenn. KC2QIQ. You have longer delays than I do. KC2RIW in the TechNet.
And to the extent, question.
Glenn first, and then Wesley next. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good explanation, Dick. And I think also, you know, it's a lot of this I'm aware of. But here again, it just sounds like some of the, just from a very simplistic point of view, you know, a lot of my experiences in power generation, you know, for switching power supplies and other things, the way that we keep transformers coupled with AC from saturating is decoupling them with capacitors. It almost sounds to me like these power companies need to, along with their mega-sized transformers, need some mega-sized decoupling capacitors in series with them to alleviate that problem. Because DC upsets are not an unusual thing at the circuit level. One would think at the power level they could be taken care of as well. It's still a very, very interesting discussion, just the point of view of NASA. And they're looking at solar spots as, you know, an event of destruction. And we as ham radio operators on the other end are looking for it. Oh, gee, we hope 10 meters will come back. Yeah, it opens up, I think, an interesting discussion there. But let me pass it back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
A decoupling capacitor sounds like a possible solution. But on one of these long-range transmission systems, power transmission lines, where you're sending 335 kilovolts, for instance, and you might be doing it with a current of 5,000 amperes, and you want to have a capacitor to give you DC isolation, and that capacitor is going to have 5,000 amperes flowing through it, and you want it to have a small amount of capacitor reactance at 60 hertz. While Wesley is talking, I'm going to do a quick back of the envelope calculation to find out how many farads must that capacitor be. So, you being a power supply designer, if I give you the task, Glenn, of designing a 5-farad capacitor operating at 330 kilovolts, how big a unit do you think that would be, Glenn? And I want it to have only a few ohms of capacitive reactance at 60 hertz. My goodness, is that a design? Yes, that's a possible solution. Another way of doing it would be to sense the DC offset that the Earth's magnetic field is being subjected to because of what the Sun is doing to us, and adjust a power supply that's in series with that 330 kilovolt transformer coupled circuit. Adjust the polarity and magnitude of that power supply, which is standing off the AC current of 5,000 amperes while generating simultaneously some number of kilovolts of DC. And that power supply has to be an extremely low impedance in both directions of the AC current on each full cycle, if you know what I mean. So that's more than a power supply.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's a lot more than a power supply. That's a very fancy electronic servo mechanism. Another very difficult design. There probably is a solution, but I haven't read in any of the good magazines that anyone has found a good, viable solution to this. Wesley, N2XJN, wait 4 seconds and then go ahead and talk. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Tesla had the answers. The government took all his notes.
Okay, N2XJN. Well, yes, there was a good response. Tesla. There was an ongoing controversy in 1897. What's better? the steady current motor or variable current motor. And of course, there was a political issue snap into that. Now, if we say that we have a problem because of the activity of the sun affecting the magnetic field of the earth, and then you say that we have a DC build up, and all of this power is actually being turned into the heat. Let me stop. So, at that point, we may assume that if we build a huge, humongous decoupling capacitor, then the rest of that energy could be actually turned from the DC to AC, creating free energy. It would not be really free energy in terms of it's free energy coming from nowhere, it would be the energy that is not wasted. And I would like you to comment on that, Dick, and to explain.
KC2QIQ with another comment.
You're absolutely right, Wesley. You're 1,000 miles of wire on a good long transmission line for this three-phase AC circuit that's sending power from point A to point B. When the Earth's magnetic field combined with what the sun is doing gives you extra DC current being picked up by that wire, it is free energy that you're being given. Right now, it is an annoying amount of free energy, which is creating a DC current, which is saturating the magnetic core of your sending transformer and your receiving transformer, and right now that extra power, which was not expected, not designed for, is an annoyance, and that extra power is creating damage. But there is extra power, extra energy, that Mother Nature is giving you at that time. So with Glenn designing the right kind of a bi-directional power supply servo mechanism-like thing, which he puts in that AC circuit, which accommodates extra DC current that the magnetic field is created in that transmission line wiring. Let me drop. And with the right kind of a bi-directional power supply, you could not only be accommodating that energy in such a way that it doesn't saturate the transformer anymore, simultaneously you could be absorbing that energy and sending it to your customers after doing some inverting to get it back into 60 cycle 120 volt power, so to speak. You could be sending it to your customers. So yes, Mother Nature is giving you some excess energy that right now we consider it a destructive annoyance, but we could be making good use out of it. So when it comes to renewable energy systems, where we talk about solar voltaic and geothermal and wave and wind and solar thermal and so on, with all of those methods of getting renewable energy resources, another one of the renewable energy resources is to make secondary use of the wiring that is our very long thousands of miles of transmission lines that are in our power circuits. And for the time being, we've been ignoring it. Wonder if you could design one of those bi-directional power supplies that absorb that energy as well as accommodating it to stop the transformer destruction, Glenn. KC2QIQ, there's a challenge for you. K2LIW and TechNet, please wait 4 seconds.
Well, Dick, I think this comes down to a very common thing. Necessity is the mother of invention. If it's required and it's needed, it can be designed. And this is an absolute truth. And I mean, when it comes down to even the decoupling capacitor, you have to imagine, first of all, that when you start looking at the numbers in power and power distribution, that the transformers themselves and these power cables are not low-expense, low-cost devices. These are very, very heavy-duty, very expensive devices that are there for a reason. They're doing a job, and they're moving a lot of energy that's very, very, has to be robust and has to be out there for years. So, yes, that capacitor is probably going to be very large, or a group of capacitors probably decouple the phases to make sure that there's no phase imbalance as well. And those will probably also have to be very large. But is it possible? Absolutely. Is it going to cost a lot of money? Sure it will. But there again, if it saves a major catastrophe, sounds like it could be worth it. Now, there again, that's one end of the analysis. The other end is exactly like you're saying, doing the electronic way. Let me let it drop for a second.
I have an interesting finding.
Well, then you, going with the electronic solution, also a very, very good thing to definitely, at best, you know, do the analysis on it and really find out if it's really feasible. The only thing that sometimes that happens where you have to balance both is to see which is more reliable, and maybe the other one has a lot more components. Sometimes you design an electronic circuit that looks like the more, you know, sexy solution in the beginning, but what happens over time is that the number of components could lead it to failure and the possibility of additional backup systems. But either way, in both applications, I can see that recouping the energy and either redistributing it back onto the power lines or using it as part of the generation system further down as a summing of additional power moving down seems quite reasonable, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, once we convert to megavolt DC power and stop using AC transmission for the long-range power transmission system, the DC voltage that the Earth's magnetic field gives you is either going to aid or buck. It's either going to be increasing or DC or decreasing the voltage that's on the line. And if it happens to be decreasing, all you've got to do is tell the guy on the other end, hey, we're going to flip polarity. Instead of me sending you a megavolt of positive, I'm going to send you a megavolt of negative. And by the way it works right now, many of these DC circuits, at least the one that Canadian Hydro is using, really has two wires running side by side. One with positive 500 kilovolts, one with negative 500 kilovolts. And if they use one of the wires, they use the remaining wire with reference to ground. So they've really got two polarities going right now. You can emphasize the polarity that gives you the aiding of voltage being picked up by Earth's magnetic field. So you can, once you go over the DC circuits, automatically this problem almost goes away. Let me drop another comment. I just did a quick calculation of Glenn's isolating capacitor to stop his transformers from burning up. Assuming that 5,000 amperes is flowing through the circuit on each one of the three phases, and assuming that I can tolerate 100 volts of drop through that capacitor because I'm running 330 kilovolts and I'm running at 60 cycles, he goes through the mathematics and the answer is 6.6 farads. So I need three separate capacitors, one on each one of the three wires, or at least two of them, and I think I'm going to need all three to have a completely balanced system. So I'm going to need three capacitors of 6.6 farads each, running at 330 kilovolts with reference to ground, and 100 volts of AC across each capacitor in order to protect my transformers. Doable, but difficult. And with a real capacitor, it's doable. If you did it with a power supply, I think you're going to be dissipating energy. But I'll have to study that one a little bit more. I guarantee there's a solution there. There's got to be a way of stop burning up transformers. But once we go over to high voltage DC, much of the problem will go away. N2XJN, wait for 4 seconds. K2RIW and SecNet. You've got it there, Wesley.
N2XJN. Well, at first, what I think the construction of this capacitor wouldn't be very difficult. To take the long enough tubes and the voltage, square voltage per centimeter or meter of these two tubes concentrically placed with the good insulation in the middle between them will be low enough to withhold such a voltage. But it's not what I was trying to say. I think I've got some findings, interesting findings. Let me drop. Okay. Now, the solar changes affect the magnetic field of the Earth. Let's say I put a plate. There is never, nowhere, at any place, energy loss. It's just the energy transfer. That means the energy is being transferred to another form. Whether it is going to be static, dynamic, potential, kinetic, we don't care. It's just the energy change. Now, the DC offset actually is the manifestation of the energy change. At that point, I would like to support myself with the question that John was trying to ask you, but for some reason he didn't ask about two magnets. And if you can send the microphone to John, I would appreciate that. And to extend.
Yeah, Mother Nature is giving us energy in many forms. And for the time being, for the previous zillion years, we've been basically ignoring it. In the far past, she was giving us energy in the form of wind, tide, and geothermal, and photovoltaic, photothermal, and whatever. Lots and lots of sources of energy that we were ignoring. We fell in love with oil, and we thought that oil and coal, and we thought that's the best one. Well, there's some strong disadvantages to using those, and the economics are starting to become significant, and the risk factors are starting to become significant. So, for us to look at these other sources of energy, the sun is supplying 10 to the 27 power watts every second of the day, 365, every second of the day for 24 hours, every day of the year, for all of the years of mankind. Lots and lots of energy is coming out of the sun. Quite a bit of it is hitting the Earth, and we're ignoring it. At 1,300 watts per square meter, my acre of property in Huntington at high noon gets 4.3 million watts of solar energy hitting it. And if I was smart enough to use the right kind of equipment out there to gather that solar energy, and I only gathered 1% of it, let me drop. That would be something like 40 kilowatts. I wouldn't know what to do with it all. 4.3 million watts of solar energy is hitting my property at high noon. And it's all going to waste. Well, it's being sucked up by the grass and the trees and whatever. But Mother Nature is giving me an awful lot of energy. But for the time being, I've been ignoring it. Someday I got to change that. Now, you've got a question, apparently, John, so go right ahead. KC2, WGB. With 4 seconds of delay, go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV. Good evening, Dick, everybody on the net. Dick, I was going to hold my question until after Mel's response to his emails. I didn't want to hold him up. I know he has to get that done.
Okay. Maybe there's a little bit more leeway tonight because the kids don't have to go to school tomorrow, but what's the most burning questions you received on your emails, Mel? K2KEY. And have you considered putting wind and solar at your property? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, in fact, that's why I left the mailbag a little later, because tomorrow is a holiday, and the kids, basically, I guess, stay up a little later, so we'll get to this interesting question in 1 minute. I'll just make a quick comment about solar energy and our little experiment that I've been doing. I have put outside, instead of night lights here that was plugged into Con Ed, I've gotten these solar charged night lights that I somewhat modified and have gotten a number of them that were supposedly no good. Took out the little solar cells, they're in good shape. And took a number of them, put them together, and I made a little larger one with a little bit of, with more LEDs in there. So during the day, it charges. I'm using a lithium ion battery, and it charges the battery during the day. Gets dark, the LEDs come on. And that was my so-called experiment that I've been showing the kids around, how I get light at night for nothing. Another, let me let it drop. Okay, well, somebody else wants to get in there, but all right, we'll get to that in 1 minute. Another experiment I was doing, I was showing them about getting hot water, literally, for nothing in the summer. I happen to have a lot of hoses, a lot of garden hoses, and some of them, you know, had holes and things for fitting, whatever, so I patched it all up and wound up with, like, 300 feet of garden hose, which I coiled up and hung on the back fence. and I have a little hand pump that is connected to it, and a couple of a pail of water that I collected actually with rainwater came down and filled up this barrel. And I showed them that just by turning the handle, the little pump was pumping the water through the coil of hose in the sun, and you'll notice the water in the barrel is getting quite hot after a while doing this. And just then the return line took it out and put a sprinkler head on and showed them that they could take a shower, a nice hot shower, just by turning this crank and making a shower with hot water, and all being supplied by Mother Nature. Dick, over.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Mel, but when I find a way of getting free energy, it gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling, and I say, hey, that's neat. When I can get free energy by just doing something crafty. And I suspect that you and the guys that you're demonstrating to this get a similar thrill out of it. Back to you, Mel, and you might want to choose a question. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KY again. Yeah, well, just you'd be amazed how fascinated young people are with that. That they, you know, they look at your puzzlement, and you're right, no doubt. Mother Nature, sun has been and the winds and all have just been calling out to us. Why don't you use us? Why are you just letting it go to waste? But as you said, as long as that oil, that black stuff, whatever it is, but oil, coal, can come out of the ground at any cost, until it's no longer available, Dick, I don't think there's going to be a mass, you know, program to develop alternate energy, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, most of the experimentation you see is done by universities, by people labs and all. There's no concerted effort, like, for instance, in World War II, when we thought the Germans were building an atomic bomb, how everything went into the development of the Americas to first come to beat them to the atomic bomb. That, let's face it, if it wasn't for that, emergency, do you think that that research would have gone ahead, Dick, over?
You're absolutely right. If it wasn't the fear of that particular war driving us, we wouldn't have put forth such a tremendous effort, a heroic effort, to develop that atomic bomb. And by the same token, the so-called missile gap of the late 60s, early 60s, late 50s, caused us to build all kinds of ICBMs and warheads, and got us into the space race. So we were scared to death that the Soviet Union was getting ahead of us, technologically speaking, and they were going to conquer the world, so to speak. So it drove us to go to the moon a lot faster than we would have ordinarily. So I guess the answer is fear is a strong driving force. Love, fear, survival, these are all very strong driving forces. And it certainly drove us during those two episodes, among others. And it's a lot more difficult. Let me drop. It's a lot more difficult to get people to join your crusade when all you're trying to do is wean the United States from petrochemical or hydrocarbon fuels. Much more difficult to get us to go away from it, because we don't sense an immediate crisis. There is a crisis. The fact that we've slowly let the amount of oil that we've imported go to 60%. 60% of the oil that we use comes from foreign places, and we are dependent on keeping peace in all of those foreign places simultaneously. If that oil flow goes down by a couple of percent during any one particular couple of month period, we all stand on gas lines like we did way back in 1973. And I'm sure you remember that very well. An awful lot of the youngsters today didn't live through that, where you could only get gas on odd and even days if the license plate had the right number on it. You can only get a couple of gallons of gas and so on. And people were getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get on a gas line to make sure that they would get there before the gas tank went empty on the particular favorite gas station they went to. That was ridiculous. So we were extremely dependent on that petroleum. And that petroleum runs all of our defensive systems, all of our war machines. So we are extremely vulnerable. We've got to wean ourselves from that situation. We have the resources to do it. We've got a whole lot of people out of work, and they could be building wind machines and solar voltaic machines and solar thermal and geothermal and tide extraction techniques. That's the quickest way to put people back into work, very similar to what we did right after the crash of 1929, before World War II, the Work Projects Administration, WPA. Put people to work doing something useful. In those days, they were doing useful things of constructing roads.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And we have a beautiful highway system across the United States as a result of that. And why in the world the NIMBYs were stopping Long Island Lighting Company, or LIPA, from putting a wind farm 4 miles off the southern shore of Long Island, and that wind farm would have supplied the electricity for 60,000 homes or something like that. Some of the major advanced-thinking European countries, Scandinavia in particular, are putting up great big wind farms out on their seashore and weaning themselves away from hydrocarbon fuels. A recent study took place, found out that the most bang for the dollar is wind. And so solar voltaic is right behind it. We have the resources to do both. I'm very disappointed that we're not doing more of that. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Did you copy that station, Dick?
Yeah, that was Joe, W2RYY. We'll pick him up in a minute. You might want to answer one of your questions, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, Roger. Yeah, you're 100% right that we're in a situation, like you say, that's very dangerous, very, very dangerous, and we're not providing for, as they say, a emergency exit from our situation as far as the dependence on foreign fossil fuels, only mainly oil. And, of course, like you say, putting the wind out on the big wind generators out there. Well, let's see. What happens if I pick up my binoculars and I look out there and I see that? Isn't that going to spoil my view? Well, you heard what the comments were. So when their lights go out, it'll be another story. But until then, this is what you're up against. Even if they said go ahead, before they get through all the different permits and hearings and things like that, it would take years. So I don't think we're going to see it in the near future. Do you want me to continue, or do you want to pick up the comment? Over.
Yeah, I think you ought to go at least to one of your questions that you get on your email system, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay. K2KEY. All right. Back apropos of this reading one. I'm a fairly new ham, and so is my friend, and we've been reading a lot about different things. And we understand that both to make an antenna resonant. But tell us, really, what is actually an antenna resonant? I guess we sort of talk about this all the time, but maybe we'll break this down a little bit. I know you've always seen the mathematical definition of X of L equals X of C. In other words, when inductive reactance is equal to the capacitive reactance. And I know that maybe sounds like, well, sounds good, but what are we actually talking about? But maybe we'll start out. Tell us, Dick, give us a few words. Let's talk about popular antenna, regular antenna, and talk about self-resonance. We always hear the term as just resonance, but it should actually be called self-resonance. As the top, I think, wording. So talk about resonance or self-resonance and actually what exactly going on. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a pretty good question. If I'm building the most basic of antennas, the one that gives you the most bang for the dollar, on HF frequencies, in the past it has been a horizontal dipole, half-wave dipole, usually made out of 14-gauge household wire or copper clad or maybe even aluminum wire. But and if you make the dipole 468 divided by the frequency in megacycles, if you make it that long, 468, and maybe it's 470, but approximately that number, divided by the number of megacycles, that means that on 80 meters it's roughly going to be 132 feet long. On 40 meters it's going to be 67 feet long. On 10 meters it's going to be roughly 16 feet long. Every one of those half-wave dipoles with that number of feet of length is self-resonant. The wire itself is a half-wave length long. That means after the signal comes out of your transmitter, goes down your transmission line, and at the end of the transmission line it hits that antenna, it sees a resonant device. That means the energy you're applying to the antenna travels down the wire, gets to the end of the wire, bounces back, and keeps ending up bouncing back and forth where every one of those bounces are in step with each other. They're all congruent steps. It's like pushing somebody on a swing. You're pushing them at exactly the right time so that the energy builds up. That's one kind of resonance. Let me drop. So the antenna itself can be self-resonant because I made it the right length and I mounted it in free space with egg insulators going to strings that go to my trees and so on. I got a transmission line in the center. The most basic half-wave dipole. Let's assume now I'm building it to 80 meters, where I want to make it 132 feet long. But now I can't make it 132 feet long because the diagonal dimension of my property is only 100 feet. And the next question is, can I build a half-wave dipole within 100 feet? And the answer is absolutely. When you make the dipole 100 feet long instead of 132 feet long on 80 meters, roughly 3.7 megacycles, the antenna is now too short to be resonant. You measure the impedance of the antenna with some kind of instrumentation. You'll come up with a resistive component that's very close to 73 ohms. That's the good news. But you're going to end up with a capacitive reactant. Any antenna that's like a dipole that's too short starts acting like a capacitor. That's a fancy way of saying the energy flows down the wire, hits the end, and comes back, and it arrives back at the center too soon. Leading current in phase. We call that capacitive reactance. You can correct for that by putting a coil of wire at the center of each half of the dipole. You can put a loading coil at that point, which slows down the signal on the way out and slows down the signal on the way back. By putting a loading coil at the center of the antenna, you have re-established electronic resonance. Let me drop. So that's one way of re-establishing resonance, by putting loading coils. Or I can put a top hat capacitor at the tip of the antenna, on the left side and the right hand side. That again slows down the signal's ability to bounce back and forth. I can zigzag the wire in between. There's a number of things I can do mechanically and electronically to make an antenna that's too short in length, but re-establish electronic resonance so that the energy bouncing back and forth goes back in step. All the bounces are lying on top of each other. They all aid each other. That's the definition of resonance. Those are some of the ways of making resonance. One of the hard things to recognize is that your antenna tuner at the jack end of the transmission line, if the antenna was too short, will also see the effect of the capacitive reactance of the antenna. The fact that the antenna is leading in phase, and it's a current versus voltage because it is too mechanically short, and as long as your transmission line is low enough in loss, I can re-establish electronically that resonance with the antenna tuner in the shack. Again, I can force the resonance. So resonance, basically you do it by having it the right length. And if you don't want to make it the right length for some reason, there's a number of things you can do mechanically and electronically to force it back into resonance. Let me drop. antenna is back into resonance, it will behave correctly, and you'll be able to transmit. If the antenna has a whole lot of capacitive reactance because you've made it shorter and used no corrective procedure, your transmitter will see a high standing wave ratio because the energy flowing down your transmission line, if it's a 50-ohm transmission line, it wants to see an antenna that is a pure 50-ohm resistor. If the antenna has any amount of reactance or any amount of resistance that's different than 50 ohms, the crazy characteristic of a transmission line is that not all of the energy that you've applied to the transmission line will get launched into that load. Once the transmission line sees a mismatch, some calculatable amount of energy doesn't go into the load. It reflects back down the transmission line toward the transmitter, and we call that standing wave ratio. We can measure the forward power to reverse power ratio, apply it to a formula, and you know standing wave ratio. The transmitter becomes unhappy when energy is reflected back to the transmitter. And the modern no-tune transmitters, if they see more than about a 1.5 standing wave ratio, which is one-tenth of the power being reflected back, if they see any more than one-tenth of the power reflected back, the transmitter goes bonkers. It goes into a self-protect mode. It either turns itself off or goes to a lower power output and might even be giving you some distortion. So establishing resonance by any one of the mechanical or electronic techniques is a very desirable thing to do. That's only 20% of the story, but at the beginning of the story of resonance of an antenna and why you want to do that. There's a lot more to it, but you gotta take it in small bites, in my opinion, because this is fairly dense stuff, if you know what I mean. Kate?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2K. K2KEY. K2LAW. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Let me see if I can put in some maybe more simpler terms, maybe. What Dick really was saying is that, as we refer to as self-resonance, most enhanced force resonance, but it can be obtained a number of different ways. One is by adjusting the length of the antenna until there is actually what is known as zero reactance occurs at the antenna input. With the pure resistance, then at the antenna terminal, we can say that, for instance, the 50 ohms that we have attained a VSWR, as it's referred to. You always see that VSWR, and that will, when they say it's 1.021, that's what happens. However, self-resonance occurs when the electrical dimension of an antenna cord feed, actually the input, what we call the input reactance, to appear to be zero. Now, let us drop up there. Another one about what Dick said about changing antenna. Of course, about that.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that switch on your mic, Mel. And are you running full power? I'm hearing a little bit of hiss in the background.
Hold on a minute. Let me put the power up a little bit. Okay, I'm going to put it up 55, put the amp 55 watt section to it. Okay, now, there is another situation about, let's drop the word self-resonance, just talk about resonance. And a good example would be in a mobile situation. Now, you see in many mobile antennas, HF mobile antennas, that they stick this inductor in there. There's a coil in there, either top loaded, middle, or the bottom loaded. Now, without that series inductor, the input impedance will contain both resistance and capacitive reactance. So the inductor may be adjusted until its inductive reactance is the same value as the capacitive reactance. That's what it's there for. At that time, the antenna actually becomes resonant. So this is just a couple of examples. I think that there's a little bit more to it. Then there's also something, well, let's say critique this before I go any further with antenna resonance over there.
Right on, Mel. So, any antenna that is mechanically too short to be the right half-wave length, if it's a half-wave dipole, or quarter-wave length, if it's a vertical quarter-wave ground plane antenna, and in the case of an automobile mobile rig on HF frequencies, you don't have the real estate to build full-size antennas. That width antenna on your automobile on 80 meters wants to be 67 feet long, and it wants the automobile to act like a great big sheet of metal that goes out there for 67 feet in all directions. The sheet of metal on the automobile is much too small. The capacitance between the bottom of the automobile and the earth is not enough capacitive coupling there, and the width itself is not 67 feet long. So you've got a bunch of restrictions for good mechanical reasons on an automobile. And the net result is you're going to put a great big loading coil at the bottom on these screwdriver-like antennas to re-impedance match, re-resonate the whole thing. So by putting loading coils in just the right place, you force that short width that may be only 10 feet long to be resonant at your frequency. You got to do a couple of other things to make it work right, but that's the beginning of the story. And that whip antenna on the car, if you don't force it to be electronically resonant at your frequency, most likely it will not radiate well. It will not keep your transmitter happy. But the ham radio operators have been down this road for a lot of years. They've worked on some very good solutions. You read the right books. It's not too difficult to make it work. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Let me say another word about reactants, because I know the word reactant can be a little bit hard to understand, as you said, when the first time you hear it. Let's look at reactants as a best way I've ever explained it. Seems to be where many people can better visualize it as a spring. Now, let's call it electrical spring. If you push on this spring, you push on it, it wants to push back or reflect back, and that's it. There's what you're doing. The reaction of the input of an electrical spring, for instance, you are pushing it with RF energy into it, but it will want to spring back at you, and that is the reflected power. So, you have this situation. There's other thing that occurs. I don't know how much we can get into this, because this is a process, and maybe I don't know if I could leave this, but to another fact in antennas that has to do with the bandwidth. And you'll have a better bandwidth, but that means they do less tuning. Now, maybe I should let that go for the time being, Dick. Over.
You're going to have to be over careful with that button. It's giving you some trouble tonight. About 10 times during that last transmission. Whenever you make an antenna shorter than the length it wants to be what we call self-resonant, 468 divided by frequency in megahertz, that number of feet of length for a half-wave dipole, whenever you make it shorter, for whatever reason, you can reestablish resonance, you can reestablish a good impedance match by using the loading coils, the zigzagging, the antenna tuning, lots and lots of techniques. But you pay a price. You can make an antenna smaller and smaller and use these electronic techniques to reestablish resonance and make it a pretty good resonator, pretty good radiator. That's the good news. But as you physically make the antenna shorter, as you use less and less real estate for the antenna, there's a property called Q, Q for Quebec, that goes up. That's really the center frequency divided by the bandwidth. If I had an antenna at 3.5 megacycles, that's half a megacycle wide, and its performance bandwidth, 3.5 divided by 5, 0.5, is 7. That antenna has a Q of 7. It tells, that's another way of saying it's got a bandwidth of 0.5 megacycles. That would be ideal. To make an 80-meter dipole cover the whole band, 3.5 to 4, half a megacycle wide, it's a bit of a trick. 32 antennas do that very well. So, whenever you make an antenna smaller, it will become more and more narrowband. That's not a showstopper. It's only an annoyance. That means every time you readjust your frequency, you QSY up the band to get away from the QR Mary. Let me drop. QR Mary means interference. Somebody else's, you know, a big gun is operating on this frequency, and you've got to tune away from him. Whenever you change the frequency, if you're using an antenna tuner, you're going to have to readjust the controls. And how much you have to readjust the controls for how much frequency movement, that's the bandwidth of the antenna. So these very short, high Q antennas, very narrow bandwidth antennas, you're going to be doing a lot more tuning. But you could do that as a lookup table. There's ways around that. As I said, it's not a showstopper. It's just an annoyance. But that's the laws of physics. Whenever you make an antenna smaller, with rare exception, it's going to become more narrowband. It still can perform. It can still give you full performance. And that's the hard one to accept. If I built an 80-meter dipole at half the physical length, you would think I get half the performance on the frequency that I have just resonated it. That's not true. You can get 98% of the performance if you're smart enough with what you do with electronics. And from time to time, Mel and Dick will tell you some of those secrets. K2KEY, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Put something on this button here. Raise it up a little bit. Put a piece of tape on it. Let's see if this helps a little bit. Basically, as Dick just said, there's where the Q factor really tells you what you can really going to be able to, how much of the band you're going to really be able to cover with the antenna. And there's where, of course, as you start to shorten down and do all kinds of other manipulations, where you most likely going to see the first problem of the change in the Q factor. In other words, if the antenna it needs retuning, again, as Dick says, not a showstopper, but it means retuning more frequent. And as he also said, of course, the newer radios are not tolerant very much of, when the standing waves start to get above 2. So that's why you have to have a tuner. I believe, basically, a tuner is a very important device. And striving for, let me say a few words about SWR, let me drop it. You know, striving to get that antenna so-called that perfect standing wave initially may be not worth all that much of effort of constantly, tuning, cutting it and things like that. You get it down to a reasonable standing wave. And then if you put a decent tuner in the system, it will suffice. You believe me, changing the SWR from 1.7 to 1.5 is not going to make any amount of signal change on the other end. Nobody's going to say to you, oh, wow, your signal was barely audible, just maybe just copying it at the minimum I could and it's about just all over the noise level. And now whatever you did, that little adjustment to brought down from 1.7 to 1.5 or whatever, that has made it now come 5.9. It's not going to happen. So try not to overemphasize, getting perfection. The idea is put up whatever you can, the best you can, and then usually a decent antenna tuner takes up whatever problems you may have there. So the idea is get on the air and enjoy it. Okay, Dick. K2RIW, K2KEY.
Yeah, Mel's right on. You adjust the standing wave ratio, you adjust the impedance match, you adjust the resonance of an antenna, for a number of reasons. Reason number one is to keep your transmitter happy, particularly if it's a no-tune transmitter, 80 through 10 meter HF no-tune transmitter. It wants to see 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. That means it can't tolerate more than about 5% reflected power before it starts doing something unpleasant. That's just the persnicketiness of these no-tune radios. Yeah, the radio is no-tune, but now you got to tune the antenna. Have we really come out ahead? I'm not so sure, but the rig is more compact. One other good piece of news is that VHF radios, 2 meters and 440 and whatever, are much more forgiving. The design is done in such a way that they will tolerate tremendous standing wave ratios and keep right on perking. And how come the HF radios are not designed the same way? That's another whole subject. And so a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio in the industry is usually defined as the gold standard, so to speak. If an antenna meets 2-to-1 standing wave ratio or better, it's usually considered a good antenna, unless you've got a very high priority need for that particular antenna for some special purpose. Let me drop. And as I said, let me drop long enough. Most of our rigs nowadays on 80 to 10 meters require something like 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio or better. But even if you let it go as high as 2 to 1, a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio is 10% of the power reflected. That's half a decibel loss in transmitted power. If the guy you're talking to has a well-calibrated S-meter, it is 1/12 of 1 S-unit. In other words, you would go from S9 with a perfect antenna, and now you flip over to an antenna with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you'll be at S8.9 or S8.85, so to speak. 1/12 of an S-unit change. Very, very little. The guy's never going to see it. Mother Nature's ionosphere is going up and down three S-units during any particular QSO. And so 1/12 of 1 S-unit is nothing. Half power loss on transmission, where he would go down half of an S-unit, 3 dB down, is a 5.8 standing wave ratio. Nobody within the sound of my voice has any pride in using an antenna with a 5.8 standing wave ratio. That's just our attitude. That's just our philosophy. Let me drop. A basic antenna with a 5.8 to 1 or even a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. If the antenna tuner has enough range and the transmission line has a low enough loss, could give you 95% of the performance you'd have with a perfect antenna. So as you can tell, standing wave ratio is a very controversial subject. But reason number one is to keep the transmitter happy. Reason number three is to make enough signal that gets to the guy you're talking to. Reason number two is how fast you have to readjust your antenna tuner, because the antenna has got a high standing wave ratio when you change frequency. So everybody thinks standing wave ratio is being done in order to maximize the signal strength that the guy in the other end hears. In my opinion, that's the third reason you adjust standing wave ratio. So lots of misunderstanding as to what it really is. And you can tune across the 20-meter band on any particular day. You can hear somebody standing on his soapbox telling you all kinds of theories about standing wave ratio and whether or not an antenna tuner does or does not waste power. You use a bird watt meter after an antenna tuner. Let me drop. And you find out you've got a 5.8 to 1 standing wave ratio. You find out the forward power is 150 watts and the reverse power is 75 watts. And you've readjusted that antenna tuner so that on the input end, your transmitter is seeing a 50 ohm load, a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. But on the output line from your antenna tuner, going into the transmission line, you've got 50% reflected power. The majority of the guys you will talk to on the 20-meter band will tell you that 75 watts that's reflected back from the antenna goes into the antenna tuner and gets thrown away. they believe it gets wasted. Absolutely not. The antenna tuner, on any bit of reflective power it sees, can only do three things with it. Re-reflect it forward, that's desirable. Turn it into heat, or radiate it from the box itself. Well, if the box is well shielded, it can't radiate it. If the box is running correctly, you put your hand on it and it's running ice cold. Therefore, by the laws of conservation of energy, you've got some very strong evidence that when you're readjusting those tuning and loading controls on your antenna tuner to make your transmitter happy, you think you're correcting the standing wave ratio or the impedance match at the antenna, and you are. You didn't realize it simultaneously when you're adjusting those controls on the antenna tuner. You are making the antenna tuner on the output end look like just the right complicated impedance, complex impedance, such that every single bit of that power reflected back down from the antenna now is being re-reflected forward, and not only re-reflected forward with near 100% efficiency, but it's being re-reflected forward in such a way that it is now in phase with the energy coming out of the transmitter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's being re-reflected forward, not only with near 100% efficiency, but it's being re-reflected forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now, and in the voltage manner they both add together. An antenna tuner can give you nearly 100% efficiency as long as your transmission line is low in loss. The one disadvantage of that philosophy of doing all of the antenna impedance matching in the shack, the one disadvantage is now in the worst case situation of a high standing wave ratio or poorly matched antenna to your feed line, you now have quite a bit of energy bouncing back and forth in the transmission line. If the transmission line is low in loss because you're smart enough to use the right material and spend the right money for that transmission line, that becomes a wash. If you're forced into using a fairly lossy transmission line and the energy has to bounce back and forth quite a few times and it gets insertion loss of the transmission line on each bounce, then you can run into a problem where you're only radiating half the power you'd like to be radiating. But again, that's not a showstopper. If your whole transmitting system ran at 50% efficiency, and that would make the average guy lose an awful lot of sleep, that's only a 3 decibel loss, 1/2 S unit. So unless you're in a pileup with a real fancy DX station and you're trying to talk to him, except for that situation, 1/2 S unit of loss at the other end, in many cases, is very unnoticeable. It's not a showstopper. Being on the air at all is the highest priority. Being on there with the strongest possible signal is your second or third priority. Maybe your second priority is not to spend a lot of money and have a rig that sounds good, doesn't have a whole lot of distortion. But once you've got a rig that's working and you can talk to people, and you can say, how does it...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, you just read a book about that. You would just tell them apart. I think it'd be a good thing if you just told them all how it is for them.
Okay. I heard a question, but I don't quite understand the question. Would you like to repeat it, sir?
Another point, Dick, I was going to emphasize.
Okay, maybe you understood it, so go right ahead, Mel. Wait for 4 seconds.
Okay, this is K2KEY. One thing that Dick was just alluding to, and I think I should bring that up a little bit more, about VSWR. That meter does not measure the quality of the performance of the antenna. It merely tells you the quality of the impedance match. And the only way to really understand or evaluate the antenna further is with an antenna impedance, an RF antenna, the exact way it will be advertised will be an RF impedance bridge, which measures both the